So if you could join me in welcoming to the stage Dr. Vijay Prashad, please.
Okay, thanks a lot. You're very kind. I was just distracted because the results started coming in from the US election. And, you know, obviously, doesn't seem to be that it'll matter for the Palestinians who wins this election. But, you know, you never know what Trump will do with maximum power, because likely it looks like he'll be the president, his party will control the US Senate, they'll control the US House of Representatives, and they already control the Supreme Court. And he wants to, and by the way, as the election results started to come out, Benjamin Netanyahu sacked his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, a genocidaire as well, but who was trying to make some critical noises, so he's gone. That was clearing the deck at the exact moment when Trump is coming to power. So I don't know what Trump is going to authorize Netanyahu to do. I don't know if they are going to strike Iran in a way that is going to force the expansion of the war in that region further than the Israelis have already expanded it into Lebanon, into Syria, and of course with the strikes back and forth with Iran. It's hard to say, but you know, what can one say? You know, it's funny, just to start a thought exercise. For decades, there's been an arid debate about whether there's, you know, the United States as the one in charge pushing an agenda against Israel, or whether Israel is driving an agenda against the United States. Decades, you know, people have said, who's the tail, who's the dog, and so on. In this particular campaign of violence against the Palestinians, it has become pretty clear that it's irrelevant. That question is completely irrelevant. The United States and Israel are one. Israel has pledged to do whatever the United States wants, and the United States has pledged to do whatever Israel wants. Israel has continued to hammer the Palestinians in Gaza, and regardless of what the leadership in Washington says, they've continued to arm the Israelis, in fact, rather deviously. So there's a threshold, there's a dollar threshold. When the US government, the executive, puts so many dollars worth of weapons in a container to send to a foreign country, they have to make a declaration. In fact, go to Congress and so on. There's a threshold that they have. The Biden administration, right through this conflict, has mostly sent weapons under the threshold, just so that there's no public declaration. It's a deviousness of the elites. They understand that within the United States as well, there is a considerable anger at the supplying of weapons to Israel, so they've been trying to do it under the radar. So when I say United States and Israel are one, what I also mean is the elites are one. I was just looking at the results in several of the US states. It looks like tens of thousands of people in states like California, Florida, Michigan, and so on, have not voted for the Democrats or the Republicans, but have voted for the Green Party's Jill Stein, have voted for Claudia De La Cruz of the Party of Socialism and Liberation, and so on. In Florida, Claudia has got over 12,000 votes already. Now, these are not enough to have made a difference to the Democrats. They are well below the amounts that might have helped Kamala Harris defeat Trump. So nobody can say, well, she lost the election because Jill Stein was in the race, or she lost the election because Claudia De La Cruz or Cornel West were in the race. But no doubt, these left candidates have attracted tens of thousands of people. By the end, it'll be 100,000 plus people across the United States, maybe more. that voted for left candidates who are against the genocide in Gaza. And that's the reason why the US government has been devious in its arms sales. Most likely, when Trump comes in, knowing his personality, he won't care. And given the fact that his party will control both houses of the US Congress, they'll just sell huge amounts of bombs to Israel and smile about it. That's the only difference, that the Democrats had been devious because they know that parts of their base had been very much against the genocide or turned against the genocide one way or the other. Interesting thought. United States and Israel won, but not only the US and Israel. Germany supplied 20% of Israel's weapons during this genocidal war. France, the Netherlands, NATO, Britain all gave complete diplomatic support. The British, in fact, provided weapons as well, because the British have one of the largest weapons companies in the world, BAE Systems. They also sold weapons, but not very large amounts. It was the United States and Germany that sold the largest amounts. Interestingly, Germany has had the most stringent attack on anybody trying to stand up on behalf of the Palestinians, at the same time as the German government has been sending large amounts of weapons and weapons systems to Israel during this genocide. So one of the interesting features of these countries, which in some ways I'm going to argue would have to include Australia and New Zealand, and that's why I was very keen to come here. This is my first time in Australia. I'm very grateful to Red Ant for giving me the chance to travel around and talk about things, but also I'm stunned that a lot of my preconceptions about Australia have been realized. Things that I'd imagined about Australia seem truer than I thought. It's really strange. Yesterday, for instance, walking along the King's Park, the King's Park brought to you by Rio Tinto. You can't have a better description of the monarchical blood money. And of course, Rio Tinto is not just a private company, it also gives money to the British royal family, because she has subsoil rights in large parts of this land. I really did enjoy that video. I don't know anything about Lydia Thorpe, but I did enjoy the video of her saying, "You are not my king, this is not your land." But of course, it's not entirely true. They do own a lot of the land, and at least the subsoil rights to the land. And unfortunately, it is also true that this country sees him as the king. That is, after all, called King's Park. I don't know which king it was named after, but I'd imagine it's a British king and not any other king. I don't know which particular one. But in a way, monarchies don't have an instantiation. It's also an abstraction. So King's Park is the British monarch, regardless of who it's named after. From that ledge there, to look over the cityscape of Perth is extraordinary. The world's two largest mineral and metal mining companies, BHP and Rio Tinto. If you know Spanish, you know that Rio Tinto means red river. Red rivers of blood, more like, you know. After we were looking out there, we started talking to four policemen who were guarding the federal parliament. We went to the federal parliament to see Solidarity Park, and talking to those policemen at the federal parliament, I mentioned to them that Rio Tinto means rivers of blood and so on. And they were hilarious because they just reacted saying, these people and et cetera, you can fill in the blanks. I don't want to say it because you're taping it and they'll know who was on duty and so on. And I don't want to get those guys into trouble, but it was really interesting how they reacted to the name Rio Tinto. I want to come to an understanding of this thing, which includes the United States, these European countries, Israel, and of course Australia and New Zealand. This thing that we in our institute have started, we've adopted a mainstream term which we're starting to analyze, called Global North. Now, before I get there, you know, when Russian troops entered Ukraine, when they entered Ukraine, there was a real frustration among the NATO countries because they found that so many countries in the developing world were insufficiently critical of Russia or refusing to criticize Russia. Months after February 2022, the Prime Minister of Namibia was at the Munich Security Conference. She was sitting on the stage with the Vice President of Colombia, an Afro-Colombian woman, Francia Marquez. And there was a German, well, needless to say, a white man in the chair of that session, two black women and a white man. And he began to hector the Prime Minister of Namibia, saying, why doesn't your country condemn Russia? And the Prime Minister of Namibia made some very interesting remarks. Firstly, she said, this is not our war. This is your war. It's a European war. We have lots of problems in Africa. You people don't seem interested. This is your problem, not ours. Why should we condemn it? Secondly, she said that, you know, when we were fighting for our national independence against German-backed rule, in fact, she didn't say that, against colonialism, you backed our enemy, and the Soviet Union backed us and gave us arms. So we have some feeling for the Russian people and so on. She made her argument. He started getting very aggressive towards her. And she just dismissed him by saying, it's your problem. Few months later, when the South Africans first approached the International Court of Justice and started talking about a genocidal situation in Gaza and asking the United Nations to define what was happening in Gaza as a genocide. See, when you go to the International Court of Justice, it's an interstate claim. So one state, South Africa, takes another state, Israel, to the court to adjudicate whether a UN treaty has been violated. And the treaty that they went there to adjudicate was the Convention Against Genocide 1951. That's basically what the ICJ case was. The ICJ case is for the judges of this body to define the nature of the conflict and then make recommendations based on that definition. They went there saying, it's genocide. Number of countries backed South Africa. They just all happened to have been developing countries, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and so on. Well, unsuspectingly, I didn't expect it. The rather pathetic government of Olaf Scholz of Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, most unlikely that you'd know his name. You know, there was a time when I was younger when we knew the names of people in the West, the rulers, you know, the presidents and prime ministers. You know, we could, you'd go to a young school child for colonial reasons or whatever, we would know who was the Chancellor of Germany, Willy Brandt. You know, a person of some culture and learning and you know, of some intelligence or whatever. These days, it's really hard to know what to make of these people. It's a little like your Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese. I mean, he's made of chalk, you know. These people are not real. They're sort of the shadows, you know. They're like the drawings made when somebody has died on the floor, made of chalk, you know, stick man, sort of put up there for the hell of it, you know. So Olaf Scholz of Germany, who really is a non-existent, you know, a man of no culture. And by culture, I don't mean anything elitist. It's just that, you know, when you hear him talk, you just don't understand what he's saying. And I'm talking about the subtitles because I don't read German. Maybe he's better in German. But in the subtitles, it's gibberish. Maybe I'm using bad subtitles, but that's what the German media gives us. And he just sounds chaotic in his opinions. So Olaf Scholz, Germany, approached the ICJ and said, this is not genocide. We would like to put in a petition that contests the view of the South African government. Well, that was interesting. The German government goes to the International Court of Justice to say that we know that this is not a genocide. Okay. All right. Already a very weird thing to do. Because, you know, basically, if I was ever asked to advise the German government, especially if in 1945 I was called in to advise the German government, I would, I think, say to them, listen, pal, For 2,000 years, or at least the 1,000 years you imagine the Reich would remain, I think you guys shouldn't talk about Jews or genocide. It should just be not something you guys talk about for 1,000 years. Because you don't really know how to talk about these things. And we get a little sick in the stomach when you're speaking in your language about genocide. Because we are reminded, we are traumatized by all the movies that we have seen. I wasn't born in the 40s, but all the movies I've seen and everything I've read, the Nazi genocide was something hideous. It was something hideous. How do they get the right? Not even two generations or three after that genocide. How do they get the right to lecture people about what is and isn't a genocide? Okay. That's what I was thinking when I saw that. The Namibian president, not the prime minister, the president also was thinking this. Because that very day, he put out a tweet, which is a very interesting tweet. Because this is what he said. He said, look, Germany, not you, but Germany, Germany, you don't have a right to tell us what is or is not a genocide. You conducted a genocide between 1906 and 1908 when you wiped out the Herero and Nama people of Southwest Africa, now Namibia. So you don't tell us what to do about this, because you still haven't apologized for that documented genocide against the Herero and the Nama. I read that and I thought, wow, this is impressive. And in our institute, we began to say, there's a new mood in the global south. Well, while we were saying all this, the press, you know, reporters like myself, so in one sense, naive, taking the mic at press conferences and saying, excuse me, US press secretary, Jen Psaki, excuse me, how do you define the global south? And there was silence. In fact, the Japanese press secretary of the government in a press conference was asked, what is the global south? And she went all over the place meandering, saying, well, it's a developing countries, but we don't know. Japan took this seriously. Every year, Japan publishes a blue book, which is a big, giant book from the foreign ministry available to the public, which goes over their concepts for their foreign policy. It's really interesting. And thanks to DPEL and so on, you can get through it. So Japan, in 2023, published a blue book in which they basically tried to define what is the global south. Now, in our institute, we had also got to work on this project. That's what became the text, Hyperimperialism, which I'm going to talk about. The Japanese had an interesting struggle. So I read their blue book, DPEL translation. Some of it was nonsensical because the app wasn't great. Tried ChatGPT, all the various apps. Basically went through it, talked to friends in Japan. Couldn't get anybody to read a giant book from the foreign ministry for us, but we worked through it. The Japanese blue book effectively said exactly what the press secretary had said. Something to do with developing countries. We don't really know. There was many, many pages of, we're not really sure what's going on in the global south. Like, why are these people speaking up? Why is a country like Namibia standing up for the Palestinians? You know, what is happening where the Bolivian government, the Colombian government, even where I live in Chile, in Santiago, the Chilean government standing up and saying this is a genocide? Well, with Chile, it's a little easier to understand. 17 million people in the country, 500,000 Palestinians. It's the largest Palestinian population outside the Middle East. Maybe it's understandable, but still, you know, many countries have a Palestinian diaspora. They haven't really condemned what's happening. Jordan, for instance, has barely condemned what's happening, given that more than half the population of the country are Palestinians. You know, the queen of Jordan, Queen Rania, has been better than the king, who has, you know, said some things, but not really enough. A little bit like Egypt, not really enough. Anyway, what is this global south? says countries like Japan, the United States, different documents, you know, statements by press people and so on, confused. We were more interested in what is the global north? Because the global south will come later. What is the global north? So this was an act of some analysis. Firstly, it was very obvious that we needed to look at the military. Now, it became clear when we looked at the statistics available by groups like SIPRI that they routinely deflate US military numbers. They deflate it because the United States military doesn't keep its entire military budget in the Department of Defense. A lot of the US military budget is in the Department of Energy, particularly atomic weapons. So how can you take the US Department of Defense numbers and assume that those numbers are US military spending, because you are not looking at the nuclear weapons, which are a key part of the United States military apparatus? So we did an audit of the 2022 US budget, and we came up with our own numbers, which are more accurate than the SIPRI numbers. SIPRI said somewhere around $900 billion was the US military spend. We found $1.53 trillion. That's a much more accurate number, in my opinion. And every year it's been going up. If you look again and audit all the major countries' weapons spending, military spending, the numbers were slightly different from SIPRI, but the biggest inaccuracy was the US numbers. What we found when we aggregated them, and I wrote to SIPRI and said, I invite you to have a discussion or a debate or whatever you'd like. Of course, they don't respond. It's very interesting to see who funds SIPRI and who operates it. I mean, it's a really good institute, but there are some blind spots which are important, I think, to discuss. And I wish they would take the time and bother to talk to us, but they don't need to. You know, they're super well more established. You know, why should they talk to us? Anyway, when we aggregated the NATO plus countries into one number, what we found was 74.3% of world military spending in 2022 was by the NATO plus countries, with the United States being by far the largest component of that entire amount. 74.3. Russian contribution to world military spending was 4% in comparison. Chinese, 10%. If you aggregate Russia and China, which is actually inaccurate to do, it's 14%. That's a lot less than 74.3%. We also, when we looked at the military, thought, let's take a look at two other aspects. One, which we published about, one we haven't published, I don't know if we will. The one we published about was the military bases. Now, there's a number of calculations of military bases. World Without War, for instance, uses a number of 800 bases. That's about 20 years old. It was used by Chalmers Johnson, who's an important analyst of US military power. He had worked inside the US military apparatus till he broke with them in the 1990s, late 90s, and so on. He wrote a trilogy of books, very good books. He also used the number 900. But this number is, I think, out of date. I know it's out of date. The real number is 900 plus, maybe up to 990. But we came to 900, roughly 900 US military bases overseas. Now, for instance, do you add Exmouth to the list of US military bases? It's basically a communications and listening station. Is that a base? Well, we consider it a military facility. It should be added to US military bases, because whether it's a place with a lot of US troops or whether they look like civilians, like in Pine Gap, where they have the appearance of civilians, but they work for the National Security Agency, which is the world's largest spying agency. Are they part of the military or are they civilians? Is Pine Gap effectively a US military base, or is it an Australian facility with US advisors? These are the kind of debates and discussions we had. Now, obviously, for your generous Australian souls, you'll say, well, it's an Australian base because we have sovereignty over our country, and these are our guests that just live in a civilian place, their children go to school there, and so on. And, you know, they don't roam around in uniforms. Maybe there's a few people, but by and large, it's an Australian base because we're proud Australians. Exmouth, well, there's Australians also there. There might be more Americans, but there's Australia. I mean, the history of that facility is extraordinary. It was just commandeered by the United States. They first took it, and then they approached the Australian government and said, we think this is a good place to set up a communications station. I don't think, if you look at the record on it, it's not like the United States came to the Australian government and said, we would like to set up. They said, this is the best place. We want this. And there it is, regardless of the coral reefs, regardless of everything else. They just established themselves there. So if you look at the bases, it's really quite interesting. 400 U.S. military bases in the Pacific. That's extraordinary. I mean, it includes, of course, the bases in Hawaii and so on. But in Japan, you know, huge, huge military properties. Four new ones, maybe five, in the Philippines. Bases in, of course, Guam, in American Samoa, in the Marshall Islands, everywhere you look. You know, and the history of nuclear testing in that region, really unremarked today. People don't talk about the Bikini Atoll and how much that island was hammered. And where the people from there now live, it's an extraordinary story of complete disregard for the communities of the Pacific. No wonder the Kanak resistance movement in New Caledonia wants to join the people of Senegal to tell the French to go home. And I think in a few years, we're going to see rumblings in Guam, American Samoa, and so on. I mean, right now, you don't have the rumblings because the populations there see a path for employment by joining the US military. There is a high school, and the biggest employer out of that high school would be the US military. There's a pathway, but I don't think that's going to last forever. I think the example of the Kanaks, the example of the Solomon Islands is going to start being contagious across the Pacific world. 400 bases just in the Pacific, 11 aircraft carriers just in the Pacific. It is really interesting that Australia has a navy, because you're defending yourself against all the invaders that are coming to take over your land, which of course most of you have taken over from people anyway, but let's forget about that. That shouldn't be remarked upon. Let's start the story with your land here. You have a navy that's patrolling the China seas to protect the sea lanes which bring goods to Australia and take Australian goods to China. So the logic of that patrol, which is highly provocative, is to ensure that the Chinese vessels continue to come through lanes which China might threaten. I mean, even saying it like that is confusing. Like, the whole thing is confusing. 900 military bases. The Chinese, by the way, no military bases. There's one base that people point to in Djibouti, which is in the Horn of Africa. I've been to that base. It's adjacent to the US base. What is the Chinese base in Djibouti? The Chinese base in Djibouti was set up so the Chinese could send their ships there to assist the UN mission against piracy in the Red Sea. Now, I am completely opposed to the UN mission against piracy, because rather than protecting the small fishermen from the big giant trawlers that come from other parts of the world, and instead of helping those fishermen recover their waters, those fishermen have become pirates against the big ships, the UN is actually going after the small fishermen. Super against that mission. But whether you are for or against that mission, that base is not an overseas base for Chinese expansion. Like, that is just not accurate. Like, I would like that base to be closed down because I want that mission to be shut down. That doesn't mean it's an overseas base for Chinese power projection. The 900 bases, on the other hand, are bases for power protection, including the base that I very much was shocked to see in terms of its size, which is the US drone base in Agadez in Niger, just south of the Sahara. It is the largest drone base in the world. You can ask me later, why does the United States have a massive drone base in Niger, which until now the government of Niger hasn't asked them to vacate, but that might come. We shall see. And that's another thought. So the military exercise of looking at spending and so on, and then looking at the NATO Charter closely, reading the Treaty of San Francisco, reading the AUKUS Treaty and so on, it becomes very clear that the Global North operates as a military bloc. It is in fact a military bloc. It operates together. Secondly, it operates as a diplomatic and political bloc. Now, obviously, diplomatic and political things are much less coherent than something like NATO, because NATO's charter says that if one of us is attacked, then all of us have to defend that country, similar to the Treaty of San Francisco. These are much more binding treaties, whereas G7 and some of the other political and diplomatic agreements are not binding. So in the last vote on Cuba, the Global North didn't vote to defend the United States in its ridiculous blockade against Cuba. Most countries of the world, 187, voted against that blockade. There's no treaty obligation to vote together. But every year, the heads of government, the foreign ministers, and so on meet at the G7 meeting, and they lay out a strategic outlook. I looked at the G7 meeting in 1974, 84, and 94, these three, just to look to see what they were like, the internal discussions. They are all available at the different presidents' libraries. So the Gerald Ford Library has a 1974 transcript of discussions. You can actually read what they're talking about. That's one of the great things about the United States, is that actually some documents are available. Like you can read most of the declassified CIA documents online. That is actually quite interesting. That's one of the interesting features of the contradictions in the United States. You can read about their coups openly. They tell you. It's right here. In Washington Bullets, the book you mentioned, I use CIA materials. I interviewed CIA agents, including the station chief in Paris, the head of operations in Iran. They talked to me totally freely. And they talked about assassinations completely freely. Partly it's because they also operate on the assumption that everything is in the past. They don't do it now. That's an amazing amnesia. And the second assumption that they operate with is, look what we can do to you. They want you to know that they can do this. It's like a message that's there for people. We can coup you. This is how we did it. They're not afraid. It's like what Chomsky calls the gangster. The United States is the mafia, the gangster. If you don't agree with us, we'll just whack you. It's a perfectly good operating principle of power. If you don't agree with us, we'll whack you. We'll sanction you, we'll kill you, we'll overthrow your government, etc. Be careful, because we've done it before. What happened to Arbenz, it could happen to you. That's the advertisement from the CIA when it declassifies documents. So we shouldn't also think, wow, they're so open-minded, they declassify documents. They declassify them because they don't care. They operate as a military bloc. They operate as a political and diplomatic bloc. That's for sure. They also operate as an intelligence bloc. I mean, you know, Australia, New Zealand, these countries are not part of the Five Eyes, and now the 11 Eyes for nothing. This country, for instance, has provided, just if we do a little history lesson, this country has provided intelligence for the United States right through after World War II. It has in fact provided military assistance right through after World War II. In the Korean War, when the US bombers were bombing dams, Australian planes flew alongside them as protection for the US bombers. Very interesting, because after World War II, a Nazi officer who had flooded the dikes in Netherlands was hanged as a war criminal. But when the US bombers smashed the dams in the northern part of Korea with Australian air support, nobody was tried for a war crime. And then, of course, Australian troops went to Vietnam and fought brutally against the Vietnamese people joining the United States. Intelligence, including the bombing of Yemen recently and so on. It's a long list of you know, acts of war crimes, criminal intent by this country, even though so far away from the rest of the world. I remember writing my book, Darker Nations, and being pretty horrified to learn that the Australian military and intelligence services was telexing names of Indonesians to the Indonesian military to slaughter the people on those lists. That's not, I don't know what that is. I don't think anybody was ever brought to account for that. You know, and they have the names of the people on those documents. Jeffrey Robinson wrote about it in his book on Bali, The Other Side of Paradise. You know, they had names of people who were telexing this stuff to the Indonesian authorities. They massacred 1 million communists in a matter of just weeks. You know, brutal, you know, participation in that, you know, politicide of the left in Indonesia. Well, so the global north acts as a bloc, and we have ample evidence of it. You know, on the case of the Palestinians, it's rock solid. You know, they're all in a phalanx. There's minor differences here and there, some criticism, some here and there, but not really. They operate rock solid as a bloc. On the other hand, the global south is not a bloc. There is no bloc. Sometimes I wish there was a bloc. People say, well, the BRICS, it's a bloc. No, it's not a bloc. The BRICS is relatively incoherent. I mean, it starts as a economic trading bloc because the largest countries in the south, particularly China, Indonesia, which wasn't originally in BRICS, but China, Indonesia, India, all of them were frustrated when the advanced financial countries went into the third Great Depression after 2006. You know, Sarkozy, president of France, comes to these countries, asks them to put liquidity into the Western credit markets. India actually finances some of the recovery. So does Indonesia, so does China. And then the West betrays them because Sarkozy told them, we'll wind up the G7 and make the G20 into the executive of the world. They never did that. These countries were annoyed. 2 years later, they have the first BRICS summit where they're discussing slowly deaccelerating from complete integration into Western markets because they don't see them as reliable. The United States no longer able to be the market of last resort. These countries start to think about South-South trading. BRICS is not a political body. It's not a military body. It's principally a trading alliance that allows the big countries of the South in particular to slowly decelerate from their reliance upon markets in the North. To assume the BRICS is more than that is not to actually follow the BRICS precisely enough. I mean, I'll give you an example. When the BRICS is covered in the press, most of the reporting on the BRICS is on the political things. They write about the political resolutions. But in fact, if you take a look at the Johannesburg Declaration, the Kazan Declaration, the largest section of their agreements are not political, are economic, are the deals they make economically. The most important side meeting of the BRICS is not the foreign ministers' meeting. It's the ministers of trade, commerce, industry, and so on. That's the centerpiece of BRICS. It's not a political body. It may become a political body, but it's not one right now. As you can see, for instance, the BRICS and the G20 are still struggling to find a common view. The big countries of the South use the G20 as a place to push back against the global North's positions. So in the Indonesia summit, the India summit, the coming up Brazil summit, the debate about how to characterize the situation in Ukraine has prevented the G20 from releasing a coherent statement because there's a big divide between the countries of the North and the countries of the South. So the G20 relatively paralyzed. But even the BRICS don't have a coherent position on some of these important political issues. None of the BRICS countries are clear, for instance, how to actually articulate a position vis-a-vis the Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Not clear what the position is. China and India call for an end to the bombing and call for a two-state solution. It's actually not exactly clear what the Russians are calling for. They're calling for a ceasefire. But then what? Who's going to do the ceasefire? Perhaps the most interesting element out of not the BRICS process, but China's new kind of diplomacy was bringing the 14 factions of the Palestinians to Beijing, sitting them down in a hotel, and having Hamas, Islamic Jihad, the PFL, the PFLP, the DFLP, PLO, etc., the small factions from Damascus, putting them all together and saying, the 14 of you need to actually work together despite your differences. And that really has been the most important political breakthrough of the larger BRICS agenda. But in fact, not really BRICS, mainly China. That's what China produced. In the same way, none of the BRICS countries have a military alliance. They have security alliances. So even, it's only been 5 years since China and Russia settled their border dispute. Only 5 years. It's only been 5 years. 5 years into the Belt and Road Project, China and Russia finally settled their border dispute. India and China border dispute continues. It's not going to be settled easily. Again, the press statements were wrong. Before Kazan, Reuters, typically, in the idiotic way they report, said India and China have settled the border conflict. No. In 2020, 21, 22, there was a conflict at Pudong Lake up in Leh, in the northern part of India, the western part of, eastern part of China. At that point, there was a clash between Indian and Chinese soldiers. So for 2 years, there was no agreement on how to patrol the line of control. And now, before Kazan, they agreed on how to patrol the line of control. That's not a resolution of the border dispute. I mean, the media is idiotic in how it reports these things. Reuters had a headline, border dispute solved. It's not solved. They've just gone back to 2019. That's not a solution. That's stupid. These countries have a lot of internal political problems. So to talk about the global south as if it is a coherent bloc is ridiculous. It's not. It is a struggling set of countries. On the other hand, there is a new mood, and that's important. Why is a country like Namibia, and this is my final point, why is a country like Namibia able to just stand up and say, we don't care what you say, Germany, this is what we feel? Why? Things have changed. And one of the most important changes is these countries are no longer captive to the IMF-controlled credit markets. Previously, when a country like Namibia would need credit, it would have to go to the International Monetary Fund. It would have to ask the International Monetary Fund staff report group that comes to visit to look at the possibility of getting a good credit, a signature from the IMF. The IMF would be like Moody's or Standard & Poor's, these ratings agencies. That's what the IMF does. It would come in and say, well, we've looked at everything. Namibia looks good. They've, you know, cut salaries for public workers. They've, you know, fired all the school teachers. It's looking really good and looking upbeat assessment. And then the Paris and London Club, private and public creditors would come and lend money. So then if Namibia made some outlandish statement saying, you know, Germany, you did a genocide on us, the German government would talk to the US Treasury Department, who would go and whisper in the ear in the IMF, and the IMF would show up and say, sorry, despite all that you've done, the country is not ready for investment, and no creditor would come to you. You would be punished. But now, a country like Namibia, and the evidence shows it, has not been going to the IMF as regularly as it used to. It also goes to the People's Bank of China, gets a currency swap, borrows money from the New Development Bank, the BRICS Bank, goes to the Indian banks and borrows money, goes also to South African credit markets, which, you know, it's not a big amount of money, but it exists. And interestingly, borrowing money from Indonesia, which has been lending to some of these countries as well. There are other countries who are carrying surpluses, who are quite happy to recycle their surpluses in the south and not in Wall Street or the City of London or Frankfurt. This has given these countries the kind of political freedom that they haven't had since at least the collapse of the Soviet Union. So this new mood in the South is not just a subjective thing. There's an objective side to it, which is that different kinds of credit markets have made these countries less captive, in a way, to the US State Department. And this is important, I think. Don't want to exaggerate the changes in the world. If we exaggerate the changes in the world, we don't understand why this genocide against the Palestinians is continuing. There is no multipolarity. That phrase is perhaps one for the future. It should not be used today. It doesn't describe the world as we know it. I'll give you an example of that. I go places and people say, well, why don't the Chinese send ships with aid to Gaza? You know, they have a lot of vessels, they have a lot of surplus. Why don't they just ride through the Eastern Mediterranean and get to Gaza and deliver supplies? People say, you know, why don't the Russians just fly aircraft into the old Yasser Arafat airport south of Rafah? Because if you understand what the US military has done to that region, you will know how hyper-imperialism works. United States has basically blockaded the Eastern Mediterranean. There is the entire fleet sitting near between Cyprus and the Gaza coastline. You may remember that when the first Gaza flotilla left, I think it was Turkey, not Greece, the first one, it was attacked by Israeli ships. And several people, including a New Zealander, was hit by tasers and almost died on that vessel. I met him in Auckland. He was telling me that story. This is not going to be a boarding by an Israeli vessel. It is most likely United States Navy is going to caution any ship that is unauthorized to cross the blockade. They are blockading Gaza with their Navy. Also, keeping their frigates off the coast of Beirut if they need to bomb Damascus. They are prepared to bomb Damascus or Tehran from those big frigates. They are also sitting in the Persian Gulf. They have moved up troop activity, so Central Command is at full status, ready to go, whether against Damascus or against Tehran. They are prepared. There is no way to go in. And right now, neither the Chinese nor the Russians, none of them, not even the Iranians, who are the more aggressive sometimes, none of them want to engage the Americans. None of them want missiles fired all around the world. When Russian troops entered Ukraine, the Chinese were extremely critical of that. They didn't celebrate it because they felt that that would provoke the United States to attack, to attack Russian soil and to place intermediate range nuclear missiles in Taiwan, which would just increase the provocation and increase the likelihood of a very dangerous conflict. Interestingly, regardless of the world media, which seems to suggest that the threats to the world come from elsewhere, the most dangerous country in the world for a long time, and for I think a long time to come, is the United States with its global North allies, including Australia and New Zealand. It is the most dangerous country. It is dangerous because it has the means to destroy us. It is dangerous because it's led by decadent political leaders who don't care about peace. And it is increasingly dangerous because it's led by reckless people who are willing to bring us to war because they are unwilling to enter the community of nations. They would prefer to go to war with China rather than build high-speed trains, phones, and things that they could compete against the Chinese companies with. Unable to do that, war is their only answer. And that's what makes them so reckless, so decadent, and so dangerous. Thanks a lot.
Always facts. All right, right now we're just gonna take a 5-minute break. And then after that, we'll transition to a Q&A. Enjoy yourselves.